So there's a bunch of reasons that I love the Bible Project, but one of the reasons is what you just watched there, right? Like, they do this great job of getting underneath the surface of all the commands we see in the Bible. Because I think one of the temptations is that we just open our Bibles and we go, it says this, I'll do that. And we don't think about, like, why is God asking us to do these things? What's the deeper intention or the driver that moves him to state these things to get us to move toward a deeper thing? And when I think about it that way and I watch this video, I think about this idea of human dignity. Like really owning the idea of human dignity, not simply for dignity's sake, but I think more deeply, when you read through the scriptures, you see that God has a heart about human beings, and it's the fact that every human being bears the image of God. It's on the front page, page one of the scriptures. God makes us in his image, and because we have that image, we have that dignity, that value, that worth. And yet because of our own selfishness, our hardness, our sinfulness, whatever, we lose sight of that. We lose sight of the dignity in us. We lose sight of the dignity of others. We do things that violate that dignity in some way. And Jesus is coming into the world to reset that, to give us a sense of vision as far as, hey, this is how you can do life different, upside down and backwards. And from that, reestablish that sense of heart and passion and goodness for seeing that dignity in play in all people, because it sees then God in play in all people, because that's the essence of the whole thing. The whole thing really is about, man, the image of God is robust in our world, and we want to honor that in all that we do. So Jesus is coming as the perfect human to teach us how to be good humans, to teach us how to be right by others humans, to teach us how to love well as humans toward one another. That's the real core of the Sermon on the Mount. And so what he's done so far in that is he's opened up with this idea of giving us kind of certain attitudes to inhabit. He's like, here's these Beatitudes. It starts with slaying your ego, and then it moves forward from there. After that, he says, hey, you have a mission. You're to be light and salt in a city on a hill that shows everybody how to do it different from the norm. And then from that, he says, the core of that is doing right by others in all the facets of life. And to make sure we get that, he says, let me give you some case studies. So the first case study was, again, kind of about our words and our dispositions toward people. He says, you might think murder is wrong, and it is, but I tell you, even hating somebody's wrong. To use harsh words towards somebody's wrong. And so he kind of puts us on notice there, like, hey, treat people different. See the image of God in people and how you feel about them and the words you say toward them. That's the first thing. Second, he says, hey, when it comes to ideas like lust in our hearts, man, that's where the real problems begin, because we objectify others. We reduce others. We limit the value of others for our own gratification, not for God's exaltation, and not for their exaltation, and even our own exaltation. And so all of that, he puts us on notice there and says, hey, there's a better way to do it, to remember the image of God. And then in this third case study that we're getting into today, he gets into this, going all the way back to Genesis, in fact, and we'll see that. And he wants to talk about the idea of marriage and divorce and remarriage and all sorts of murky details. And so that's what we're going to get into today. Now, as we go that direction, I want to encourage you, if you haven't taken advantage of our app, there is great stuff in the app. There's all sorts of things you can utilize. One of those is notes. And so today, all of the stuff we're going through, it's all in there. You can follow along, fill in the blanks, that kind of thing. That'd be awesome. Also in there, at the beginning, is a podcast, which is just kind of running in tandem with the Bible Project stuff. I'm encouraging everybody to try to do this series in layers. As we go through 2025, man, my hope is that by the end of this year, in your head, you will really know the Sermon on the Mount. You may not memorize everything, but you'll go like, I remember those are the core values that help me be different in this world, upside down and backwards, to make a difference for Jesus and make a difference in the lives of others. And so again, I encourage you to do that as well. With that said, I'm gonna go ahead and pray, and we're gonna get right after it today, because we got some ground to cover. Let's do it together. Jesus, I come before you, and I first ask you to show us all tremendous grace, all of us. I pray that we know the grace that you show. I pray that we are reminded of what the writer of Hebrews says. It says we can come before your throne with boldness, and we can find grace in our time of need, because I know we're going into places that for different people in different ways is going to touch different nerves, and I pray for your blessing. I pray for your encouragement. I pray for your peace. I pray for your wisdom and stamina for us, and that we know really in this that you love us and care deeply for us. So give us insight for today. Give us what we need for today. May your Spirit speak into us so that we can be strong in you. And so we look to you, Jesus, and love you in your good and kind name. Amen. All right, so today, a couple of things. First of all, kind of as a disclaimer, I want to acknowledge right from the get-go that the world that Jesus was in and the world that he was speaking into, especially on the topic of the day, was just fundamentally a different world than ours, right? So in a strange sort of way, I'm going to be a little bit more of a teacher to that world and trying to explain that world, and then maybe from that we can find some grounding in our world, but they are distinctly different things in play, and the rules were different at that time, and so we're just acknowledging that fact, right? And so that's going to be a little bit unique for today. The second thing I want you to know is that I realize that in this room or watching online, there are going to be a decent percentage, in fact, of people that somehow are touched when it comes to this topic, right? So either you've gone through a divorce and a remarriage, or right now you admit that in your heart you're contemplating that. You're contemplating a divorce. You're thinking about it. You might even be wishing for it. You might be secretly plotting to go down that road. And I want to let you know right up front that here's what I'm not here to do today. I am not here to pretend that I know your story. I am not here to dig a knife. I am not here to leverage shame. I'm not here to do any of that. That's not my heart. So I know sometimes with pastors, they can get up and they can just talk real tough about real tender things. And that's not going to be me today. At the same time, what I also want to do is honor Jesus' words and his wisdom, along with the idea that I think what he's getting at more deeply is not just simply the rules, but he's getting to the undercarriage of this idea of, again, human dignity, the image of God, flourishing in our world, and that matters to him. And so today is going to have, in one sense, a general feel to it, but hopefully by the end we can give some practical things for all of us to consider. And so that's kind of the essence of what we're doing today. Now, with that said, like we said, we're in the series of case studies. Jesus has six in Matthew chapter 5. The first was harsh words that we can use toward others that diminish the image of God in them. The second was then covetous kind of longings that can diminish the value of others because we want them to satisfy us in some way. But both are kind of prequels then to the third thing. Right? When you're angry and you use harsh words and you wish you had somebody else, that usually leads to then this discussion that Jesus moves into when he says in verse 31 in Matthew chapter 5, it has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, we're going to leave this for a little while. We're going to go to other things. We're going to come back to this. We're going to address those Greek words, porneia and mycurio, and we're going to try to unpack those toward the end of our time together. But a couple of things you have to understand about this as we begin to dig in. First of all, this discussion in Jesus' world was a substantial debate. So when you saw the Bible Project video and they were talking about that, it really was. I mean, it wasn't like a casual thing. This was something the rabbis would get together, they would powwow about it and fight about it and argue about it, and the clans would argue and everything else. That was kind of their spirit. And so this was something in their world that had a bunch of preconceived idea around it. So when Jesus says it, he's saying it into that world with those kinds of circumstances and realities before them. That's the first thing you have to kind of understand about that. The second thing is that the debate was really revolving around a single Mosaic code, right? So Moses had case laws, a bunch of them, and Jesus is speaking into that case law, about that case law. But to understand this, you have to go back to the case law itself. So in Deuteronomy chapter 24, it says this: if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds some indecency about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, and he gives it to her and sends her from his house, and after she leaves his house, she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce and gives it to her and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled, for that would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Yikes, man. Like, you just read that, and you're like, okay, so she gets married, this dude doesn't want her anymore, kicks her out, she goes to another guy, he doesn't want her, and the first guy can't because it's, what do you do with all of that, right? I mean, even all of the and that is just crazy. Now, on the surface of it, we can just take it and say, all right, when Moses rolled in, he permitted it. Jesus rolls in and says what Moses said, scratch that, and I disallow that. That's not the case. I have a tighter view. That would be a very simple way to look at it. In some ways, I think it's even pretty accurate. But here's the thing I also know about case law and rules and statutes and everything else. They can get complicated really quick, like super fast. If you don't think that's the case, I'll just give you a very simple example. Our own Bill of Rights, right? The First and Second Amendment, you would think are straightforward, just straightforward. First Amendment, you have freedom of speech. And we go, that's just universal. Everybody has that freedom. But guess what? A student in a high school class does not actually have that freedom. If they tell their teacher, pound sand, screw you, I'm not listening to you, there's no free speech there, right? So suddenly that free speech law is a little complicated. I can't go into a theater and yell fire. Suddenly I don't have free speech anymore. So the law is a little more complicated than we think. Second Amendment, the same way. I have the right to keep and bear arms. So if I go, sweet, I'm going to go buy a bazooka. They say, you can't go buy a bazooka. I'm like, why can't I have the right to? No bazooka, but other, like, it gets complicated quick. It's not as simple as on the surface. And the same thing applies here, right? And so based on that, Jesus is speaking in the Sermon on the Mount to it, but he has a more protracted conversation about it if we fall back deeper into the Gospel of Matthew, into chapter 19. Here's how it opens up in verse 3, right? So some Pharisees, because they're always thinking, just imagine like the March of the Empire in Star Wars, right? So Pharisees enter in, and they tried to trap him with this question. Should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for just any reason? Right? So a couple of things about this. First of all, it's an entrapment question. Right, so they're not like curious, like, hey, man, we're trying to figure it out, you know, give us some insight. They're, no, we're going to get him. We're going to get him on this. But they are bringing up the nuances of the case law and their culture. And so to go back and understand this in their world, first of all, in Deuteronomy 24, there's different layers to it, right? So again, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing, or if he finds something indecent, then he can issue a certificate of divorce. Just those colors right there, right? Becomes displeasing, finds something, and indecent represents the three primary schools of thought on the subject. So the first of the rabbis, if you will, it is Rabbi Akiva right there, and he was more liberal. And he says, basically, if she becomes displeasing, it's just for the husband. If he's like, I don't know, man, I didn't know she would drool like that when she sleeps, you know? No, I mean, it's like a river. It's something else. You know, I wake up wet, and she's the one doing the drooling. Like, it could be like that. It could be like, she burns food. I don't like that. She's getting older. I want a younger one, whatever it is. So there was one school of thought that was just kind of more in that liberal space. You also had a more moderate view of this. This was Rabbi Hillel, and he focused more on the finds something. So it couldn't just be like she drools. It had to be something of substance. Right? It doesn't matter what it is. Maybe she just argues too much. She's difficult. You know, you didn't think she was going to be like this. When you were dating, she was so fun. And then once you got married, she was such a ball and chain. Whatever the thing was, it had to be something. But if you had the something, it was good enough. And then you had Shammai. And Shammai was the more conservative. And he says, no, it's the key is indecent. There has to be an indecency that's related to her action. And he would put it more in some sort of sexual kind of indecency. So there was some infidelity on the part of the wife in some capacity, whatever it is. So you had these different schools of thought. The Pharisees are asking this question, knowing there's these different schools of thought. And their heart behind it is they want to trap Jesus. Now, in their world, the more popular views would have been more of the liberal to moderate. Like, the conservative view was held by some. Moderate would have been probably the most normative, but the liberal view, that was sort of open too. Now, here's the trick about this. This is where you have to kind of get so inside their culture to understand what's happening here. The question is, how is this an entrapping question? Like, how is it entrapping? If you have a whole range of versions, the majority would fall liberal to moderate. Maybe a minority would be conservative, but none of those are going to be scandalous. What kind of answer would they anticipate Jesus giving that would be a scandalous answer? Now think about it. What do you know about Jesus when it comes to religion? How did they view him? Well, they certainly viewed him not as conservative. They viewed him as kind of a liberal guy. He's always hanging out with the hookers and the drinkers and the tax collectors, and he's loose with the law. So they probably would anticipate he would land more on the liberal side, which is then shocking when Jesus kind of goes so conservative. That might jar some stuff there, but again, it wouldn't be scandalous. Here's what they are banking on, right? I really believe this. I think what they're looking for, if it didn't say entrapment, I think it would be different. What they're banking on is that Jesus' answer, whatever he gives, is not going to fit any of those categories. And where it's going to side, ready, is not with the men, but with the women. And they're banking on the idea that Jesus will side with the women in this debate. And that would be scandalous. Now, why do I believe they think that way? Well, this is already something that's clearly delineated in Jesus' ministry. Jesus ended up being very pro-women in a very man-oriented world. So much so, in the Gospel of Luke, it says that women were funding his ministry, right? They were financially backing him, it says. And he was showing dignity and value and worth to the woman with the blood flow. She was untouchable. Nobody wanted her. A Syrophoenician mom with a demon-possessed daughter. He cares about her. He meets this woman at the well. He invests into her. Like, Jesus was scandalous because he actually saw women with a type of equality that world didn't see. And so they're asking the question, and they're hoping, they're praying, they're begging, oh man, let him do something that sides with the ladies. And that will show he's not of God. Because in this whole discussion, divorce was a man's domain, right? It was just a man's domain. That's what the law is. A man has to write a certificate. There's no, if a woman writes a certificate, that didn't happen. They didn't have that right. They didn't have that possibility. And so you have women, they had no rights, they had no recourse, they had no follow-through, they had no way to pursue it if they were somehow in trouble with their marriage. In other words, women were the powerless victims of the divorce industry, if you will, of the reign and rule of Jesus' time, right? And so if that happened, a woman would just be, she's out. I don't want you anymore because you drool, you burn my food, you don't like you, you're too old, whatever it is, and out the door. And there was just nothing else that could happen. Now, here's what I think this hints at the bigger thing with Jesus. One of the things he says he came to do is to care for the powerless. He came to kind of stand with those who had no recourse or no dignity in that culture. And so again, I think the Pharisees are betting on this. They're hoping that's what he's going to do. The problem is they're playing checkers. He's playing chess. They don't know it yet, right? And so it says some of the Pharisees came and they tried to trap him with the question, should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for just any reason? They just want to know, hey, what's the line of acceptable divorce? And ooh, what is he going to say about men and women? But Jesus is going to deal with the reality of marriage, like how it began, like how it really matters to God, how this references his image in some way. Now, what's important about this, I want you to understand again, just I want to make sure it's anchored, in their world, a woman or a wife to a husband was a possession, was property. Right? This is why the 10th commandment is, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or donkey. Like, that's a comparison, you know, or his stuff. It's because she's a possession. Even the way we do weddings to some degree, like my daughter, who's a little bit more on the progressive side of life, she's like, okay, I don't know if I want you to walk me down the aisle because if you say, who gives this woman to this man? I'm not your property. I'm my own independent person. I'm like, oh, how about we say presents? Perfect. All right. presents, not gives. You're not mine to give away or you're not property, right? But in their world, a woman was property. And in that, there was a general sense of female inferiority when men looked at women. And if you don't believe me, there is a daily prayer of the Jewish men, 3 times a day, said, O Lord, King of the universe, thank you that I wasn't born a woman. That was men's daily prayer three times. You hear it in The Chosen, they've disrupted a little bit. It's like, oh Lord, King of the Universe, thank you for the bread of the earth or whatever. But it was originally, again, oh Lord, King of the Universe, thank you that I wasn't born a woman. Imagine if your husband prayed that three times a day. Right? Like you might think like, maybe he doesn't see me as an equal fully. It might be a problem, right? But Jesus holds a more radical view, both on marriage and on women, and so he states that. He says, haven't you read the scriptures? You want to know if a man can divorce for any reason, but haven't you actually read the scriptures? Which is funny, saying it to a religious leader. They're like, whoa, what you talking about, Willis, right? So he says, they recorded that from the beginning, God made them male and female. That's Genesis 1. And then he goes into Genesis 2. This explains why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. Since they are no longer two but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. So they want to know about a debate on the legal code, and Jesus is like, yeah, that's cute. Let's push that to the side for now. Let's get back to our original intention. Let's get back to design. Let's get back to what the scriptures say, right? You're worrying about whether you can kick your girl to the curb, but God has a much grander view, even more important than divorce. And Jesus is going to something deeper than just marriage and divorce. He's tapping into something much more radical to me. In fact, I think Jesus says way more here than we realize. Way more. Again, thinking about their world, first of all, what he's saying by quoting this, like you haven't read the scriptures. You're stuck in case law under Moses in the desert and those problems. You haven't read that a woman is more than property. She's more than property, right? She's to be treated with the same sense of she's a co-heir and a co-equal as an image bearer as you men. Because that's the way chapter one starts, right? He made hims and he made hers and he made them to bear his image. That's a powerful idea. And he's just wanting to know, before everything came off the rails, before we all became really good at being really selfish and really sinful, there was a co-equality there, and that got dismantled due to our hardness. The second thing he's going to highlight here is this idea that the woman was divided from the man, because we're going to go back and think about Genesis 2. Right, so man was put in the garden, God brings a sleep on the man, then he takes the woman from the man, and then when the man wakes up, he brings the two back together as one flesh. And in that, there's actually a different mathematical formula. It's not just 1 + 1 = 2, but it's kind of like 1 + 1 + 1 = 3 in 1. Right, because what you have there is when they come together, they are embodying the image of a communal God, a plural God. We have a Trinity. And you can break this out either way. Like, there's myself, and then there's my wife, Ellie, and she's one, and I'm one. But when we come together, not only is that God doing this, which is three, but another element of that is when we come together, we kind of form a third type of person between the two of us. Our community, our togetherness creates a new disposition as a couple that was different than our separate dispositions. And so even that is a powerful idea. In fact, kind of created this little image so you get that. As a guy, I'm a unique image bearer. My wife is a unique image bearer. But when we come together in our union, we are describing and displaying a different way that God is in us. And so Jesus wants to protect all of that. That's why he's kind of grounding it back in these principles. And so from that, then, the third thing, what he's getting at is to split what God has joined. It's possible. It is possible. He says, let no one do what God put together. It means it's doable. It can be done. But it's not ideal or scriptural or peaceful. It's not going to lead to flourishing. And so here's how I was thinking about it this week. Each one of us starts off as an individual, right? We're kind of like this clay that God is molding and life is molding and works us through over the course of time and shapes our disposition and our person and our reactions and our motivations and our hobbies and our interests. That's kind of what we are. And we do this for a long time as an individual. We grow up, right? But eventually, God then brings another person into our life. And Jesus says these two start to become one in marriage, right? And you could think, well, that's pretty easy to undo, but that's not really oneness. That's just two-ness kind of a little intertwined. What really happens in marriage is more this. You merge your bank accounts. You start sharing space together. the toothpaste tube. You have debates. Which direction the toilet paper goes, this way or that way, you have debates. Then you have kids. You get really merged, man. You tolerate each other's bad breath and bad behaviors and everything else. And Jesus is like, you really get intermixed. Now when it's time to divorce, try taking that apart, right? You could start to try to work at it. You can try to get the pieces out. You can try to segregate it, right? But the reality is, it's just never going to quite go back the same. Like, you could probably, but the more you intermesh, in fact, the more problematic it's going to be, the more challenging it will be over the course of time. And so I think in that sense, you know, when Jesus is saying this, he's kind of talking practically as well as he's talking sort of like deeply, spiritually, intimately. All of that is in there. And so from this, the question emerges on the part of the leaders. So he's kind of laid this case of, man, they become one. Don't let it separate, because, man, it's going to be all this pain, all this challenge to do that. There's so much breaking that happens in the separating. And so the Pharisees are like, well, then wait a minute. Why did Moses say in the law that a man could divorce his wife if he just gave her a written notice and then send her away? Why did that happen? Jesus, you're challenging an idea, but our man Moses wrote it. And Jesus replied, well, Moses permitted divorce only as a concession to your hard hearts. But it was not what God had originally intended. I tell you this, whoever divorces his wife and marries someone else commits adultery unless his wife has been unfaithful. So what's interesting here is that the way they were seeing that is a permission, right? Like a man's right. I can outsource her, I can upgrade her, whatever we want to do. And then Moses says, yeah, or Jesus says about Moses, he goes, yeah, here's the thing there, man. That's because you guys are dirtbags. It's so funny. Like, well, wait a minute, though. I mean, Moses said, he's like, right, Moses said that because he knows. He knows you have a hard heart. Right? Because here's what's happening, right? In some ways, I would say the law, even for Moses, is a kind of mercy toward women. And here's why. Again, if a woman is a man's property as his wife, and he decides he doesn't want her and he kicks her out, she has no options in that culture unless she can remarry. Or her options are different. She's either going to be homeless or she's going to go into prostitution. And those were the common things, especially in the ancient Hebrew culture. If a man says, I don't want my wife, she doesn't have income. She doesn't have a great way to get revenue. So it's either going to be she has nothing, she's homeless, or she just turns to prostitution because she's still the property of her husband, unless there's this certificate of divorce. And so the certificate frees her to have some options. She's still going to be a little bit marked in that culture. It's going to be like, oh, she's had some husbands or whatever. But that at least she can do something else. She's not just forever ratcheted to this guy as his possession. In fact, just as a sidebar really quick, in John chapter 4, Jesus meets a woman at the well. Right? It's this beautiful story. We read it so outside of its culture because Jesus and her are talking and they're talking about where to worship and everything else. And then he says, go and get your husband and bring him here. And she goes, well, I don't have a husband. He says, you're right, you've had five. And the man you're with now isn't actually your husband. Now, I'll tell you how we read this really broken. We read that as, man, she must have been getting around. She was not a keeper. Five husbands, and now the guy she's with doesn't even function as her husband, and we kind of diminish her or demote her. We forget in that culture, she could have had five husbands that just kicked her out the door and gave her a certificate of divorce. Maybe the last one, the fourth one, or the fifth one, did not give her a certificate, so she's with this guy now because the last husband didn't cut her loose. Didn't even show her that kind of mercy, right? So that character may be very different, and she's more at the mercy of the problems of the culture, right? And so Jesus says, man, it's your hardness. That's the issue. And so from that, he's giving both a higher standard and one rooted in dignity and value and human image bearing for others, and a theology about, hey, man, this is all about bearing the image of God, and it's about seeing your women with an image of God just as much as you men see yourselves with an image of God, and all of that is what matters. In fact, this idea that he throws out there is so radical that not only are the Pharisees going to be like, oh, dude, what do we do with that? We don't know what to do with that. That's a tilt, right? But even his own disciples. So the disciples said to Jesus, if this is the case, it's better not to marry. What a bunch of lug nuts, man. They're like, let me get this straight. I can't divorce my wife for just any reason. why should I get married, Jesus? I mean, it's like that. It's like they can't even process this idea that, whoa, that's like making her a ball and chain. What are you kidding me? Like, they're just broken in that. But I love what Jesus does. He doesn't scold them. He says something really interesting. He says, not everyone can accept the statement. Sometimes he just says, what's with your faithlessness, Lord? But this time he's like, man, not everybody can accept this statement. He's got a high standard all the way around. He says, only those whom God helps can really kind of get this. Because he says, some are born as eunuchs. Some have been made eunuchs by others. And some choose to not marry for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who can. Do you not read that and go, what a weird place to go? Like, he says, hey, man, marriage is a high standard. Holding women to equal as men in image and dignity and value is a high standard. And they're like, how can we do this? It seems crazy. And Jesus is like, let's talk about eunuchs for a minute. Just seems odd. But again, he's tapping into this idea that, man, for the eunuch world, marriage was not going to be in the equation. It would be like kind of being single. For some, it's forced upon them by way of birth. Right? It's so strange. The Bible, we deal with all these modern problems like intersexuality, which is a medical term for people that are born with both genitalia, or there's confusion biologically or physically on what are they, male or female. That was a first century world issue too. They're just born eunuchs. They're probably not going to be in the marriage conversation in the same way. It's a really interesting dynamic just even to think like they wrestled with those questions, right? Just as much as we do. But he's like, the deeper thing is, yeah, man, it's a big deal to be married. It's a high and lofty thing to appeal to, right? And with this, the higher point is just don't enter it lightly. Yeah, if you guys all went into it thinking you can get out of it easily, he's saying this to his disciples or saying to the Pharisees, you've missed the equal value, you've missed the beauty of, you've missed the purpose of, you've missed the first two pages of what God is unfolding in the world, right? It's a lifelong bonding. That's the intention, not just simply the rule, but the intention, the heart behind the whole thing. So then going back into the Sermon on the Mount then, right? He goes back to the statement and then the exception he gives in the statement. So he says, if anyone divorces his wife, he must give him a certificate of divorce. That's the way you guys have seen it. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality or porneia. So we're going to get into that word porneia in a minute, but the question is, because I want to just try to be open with us today, the question is, hey, is that the only exemption that the New Testament speaks of when it comes to why a person is permitted then to divorce? Like, Jesus is very strict, except this one thing, is that the only one thing that the New Testament highlights? Well, on the surface, you would think that must be it. But Paul says something in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, which is a weird statement. Paul's like, okay, this is not what Jesus says. This is what I say now. He's given a different thing. He says, if a fellow believer has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to continue living with him, he must not leave her. And if a believing woman has a husband who is not a believer and he's willing to continue living with her, she must not leave him. But if the husband or the wife who isn't a believer insists on leaving, let them go. In such cases, the believing husband or wife is no longer bound to the other, for God has called you to live in peace. Now, I think this is interesting because it seems like Jesus says there's only one exemption, and then Paul's like, well, there's this other exemption. And you're like, well, what is it? And I go back to this idea that what I think the heart of the scriptures are is ultimately the development of wisdom and insight and a high view of God's image in others and all of that's in there. And so in Jesus's world, a Jewish world with rabbis debating Mosaic law, he speaks into those conditions and he's confronting their hardness and he gives that statute for them because of their problems. Paul is dealing with the Gentile world. He's dealing with the slave trade. He's dealing with owners of slaves that are intermarrying them and then selling them off to others and this whole different kind of thing. There's something about a present distress that Paul is even encouraging. Don't marry, stay single. That's a better idea than to get married. Like, they're each speaking into different worlds. And I highlight that because I'm not trying to say, oh, so anything can be an out as long as you have this. I'm just saying that they're both trying to deal with different problems in different ways, bringing different insights. And the bigger issue always is related to wisdom, is related to the heart to honor God, is related to the heart of elevating those around us, particularly our spouse, to see their dignity, their value, their worth, to want to emphasize that, to want to protect that. Like, that's the deeper core. And so Jesus has a high view of marriage, but he also has a high view of the value and dignity of others. I say that because, again, what always comes up in this discussion is, well, Matt, what about a spouse that is being abused? What about a spouse that's being neglected? What about a spouse that feels violated for reasons outside of sexuality? And I go, the scriptures just don't speak to those things. I'll tell you, as a pastor, I've had people that are being physically abused by their spouses, and I've never said, well, sorry, it's not an out, so you got to stay. I've just never said that. I would never put that on the shoulders of a person. This is, again, where I think there always has to be a greater sense of wisdom and grace, not trying to find the easy out, but at the same time wanting to have a high view of Jesus's values. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is just going back exclusively to Jesus, his exception for pornea. It's where we get the word pornography, right? So it's just kind of the link. But here's the thing. It's a little bit weird in the passage. So again, this is my professor teacher for a minute. What's weird about the passage is that Jesus says, you know, I don't permit a man to divorce his wife for any reason, except he uses this word porneia, and then he goes into this word adultery. And the question is, why didn't he just use the word adultery? I don't permit a man to divorce his wife unless she commits adultery, and therefore it would make a lot more sense. This word porneia then is weird. Like, why inject that word? And I'll be honest, we don't quite know fully what this word encapsulates. It literally means to sell. That's what it means. And in their world, most exclusively, it was about prostitution. So Jesus may be making a very strict statement. He may be saying, hey, I don't permit this except unless somebody has been a prostitute in the marriage, and then you can do this. That might be how strict he's being. It could also be just slang for selling out on the marriage, and therefore it's any kind of sexual impropriety. It could be pornography. It could be just an emotional affair, you know, whatever. I'm just telling you, we don't know. We don't know for sure what he's getting at, right? Not 100%. But he is saying, hey, it has to be like an offense of some level that really is violating at a deep component that deals with kind of the, if you flip it, it harms the dignity of the one that's honoring the marriage. You're not dignifying them with your actions. Now, with all that said, Jesus and Moses and the scriptures don't require divorce for some kind of porneia. It permits it. It allows it. At the same time, I don't want there ever to be pressure that says, oh, well, then if I don't just stay with my spouse after that, then I'm less than, I should have been forgiving and just stayed. I don't want that pressure either. I'm saying it's there as a permission. It's not there as a requirement, but it's also not there as a heavy hand to keep you from doing what you feel you need to do. Again, it's a grace and a mercy in a time where there was wounding and suffering. And Jesus and like Paul both would say, and God desires you to live at peace in all of this. He doesn't want you to remain in an overly burdened condition where there is this permission granted. The third thing I want to say about this that I think is super interesting in Jesus' words, and I think it goes back to the theme, has to do with the fact that Jesus is siding with the plight of women in their culture, and this is why I think it's so fascinating. He says, but I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for porneia makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So let me put it in a different way. Jesus says, all right, Moses allowed this because your hearts are hard, men. But if in your hardness you send your wife away for a reason outside of porneia, here's the reality. She will become an adulterer to somebody probably, but her guilt falls on you. It doesn't fall on her. He says, you make her. It's an active idea of you, the husband, make your wife an adulterer. And it's falling on you as the husband because you did that. And it falls on the other dude for doing this too. So it's a wild, wild thing. It's super radical. But again, this is why I say, again, the conditions that Jesus is speaking into are a little different than the conditions that we're speaking into today. It's not exactly the same world, but he's getting into, man, you want to use, you want to misuse, you want to abuse people. It's going to fall on you if you're doing that. If you're just kicking them to the curb because you don't want the hassle anymore and you don't care, he's like, that's going to be on you as the husband to this world here. So it's a real strong thing. I can't help but look at that and go, I love the fact that Jesus is all about the business of kind of putting blame where blame is due, especially when power is out of balance, where control is out of balance, where, I guess, advocacy is out of balance. Because, again, Jesus knows that women don't have an advocate, so he advocates for them, and he stands with them and for them. I say all that because, again, I think that's the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, in our modern world, it's different. The conditions can be different, but we should always be thinking about those same things. So based on all of that, let's try to wrap this up really quick. What are some things that we can kind of walk away with today? Well, the first thing is this, and this is outside of the question of divorce and remarriage and everything else. It's just the fact that we see Jesus standing with victims. And I believe in the same way, we should do the same thing. When you see that power's out of balance, that law's out of balance, whatever, you should stand with the victims. And often when you do, it's going to be unpopular. Like, the power holders of Jesus' day did not go like, oh, what a brilliant answer. No, they're like, man, he's disrupting everything. But it's important. Second, here's the question. What if I'm divorced and remarried for reasons not outlined in those things we looked at today? So Matthew chapter 5, Matthew 19, 1 Corinthians 7. What if my reasons were different? Maybe a different way to ask the question is, am I in perpetual adultery? That's what people ask. Like, if Jesus says it this way, does that mean we are always and forever in adultery? And I would say no. I'd say you should go back and take an inventory of like, hey, what led to my original marriage divorce? What were the things in me that probably were unhealthy? What were ways that I contributed to the problem? And how can I be more like Jesus as I move forward in my new relationship? And just doing it that way, that's a good, healthy way to do it. Taking that inventory is a healthy thing to do. How about this? What if I'm considering separation or divorce for reasons not outlined in the scriptures? For, again, Jesus's porneia or Paul's abandonment. Here's my encouragement to you. Maybe three things. First of all, I would encourage you to seek good, wise counsel, not reactive counsel. Not like, that's right, kick him to the curb. Like find really thoughtful, wise people. The second thing I'd say, take Jesus's vision, like, really seriously, like, as you're analyzing all of it, to be like, am I holding my spouse with dignity, value, and worth? Am I seeking to be the kind of person I need to be? Am I giving my all to this, trying to see it be healthy and good and right? Do I hold God's view that the two become one, and then that's really three, and that really matters? It's like you kind of go, like, can it be salvaged? I want to do my best to try that. At least I encourage that. So what are some ways we can heal a hurting marriage? These are really fast. Aids for healing a hurting marriage. These are also in your notes at the bottom. Seek counsel. Just seek counsel. Improve communication. Rebuild trust. Practice constructive honesty with yourself. Like, just look at yourself like, am I part of the problem here? Am I being the problem? Man, show appreciation to your spouse. Spend quality time together. Address issues promptly. Be supportive. Enhance intimacy, practice forgiveness, and if anything, love your enemy. That's a good one. When Jesus says, like, love your enemy, he says, man, do good to them, pray for them, bless them. That's that kind of thing. And then what are ways that we can actually disenhance our marriages? Preventative medicine is so good. How about this? Deepen communication. Share your faith or convictions with each other. Surprise each other. Learn together. Travel together. I know some of you are like, we travel together. We start to talk about divorce. No, travel together. It's a good way to find the margins, all right? Practice gratitude. Stay active. Maintain individual interests. Be playful. And invest in intimacy. All right? Being human is messy. It is. Being married is messy. It is. But Jesus is giving us these ways to bless the mess so that we can change the world one marriage, one relationship at a time. Let's go ahead and pray together. Jesus, so much in a concentrated amount of time. So many emotions that are in this. So many different things. I mean, I know that marriage is complicated. Divorce is complicated. Remarriage is complicated. Life is complicated. Faith is complicated. I thank you then for your grace. I thank you for your wisdom. I thank you for the pressure you apply and how you get us to look at things from a different point of view. Today, I especially thank you that today is also Communion Sunday. And I think about how communion so much mirrors marriage, this idea of two becoming one. In communion, we become one with you, we become one with one another. And it's the same thing of bonding and intimacy and seeing that human dignity and value that you came to rescue and to redeem. So as we take communion today, I pray that that will be our mindset, right? That we want healing, we want flourishing, we want beauty and all that that entails. So help us to be what you want us to be and help us to look as you want us to look. In your good name, amen.